This is Marginalia, a production of KMUW Wichita.
Marginalia. Notes in the margin of a book.
Notes, commentary, and similar material written in the margin of a book.
Comments and notes which are incidental
or additional to
the main topic in the margin of a book.
In this podcast, I visited with Ulrich Boser about his new book, Learn Better, Mastering the Skills for Success in Life, Business, and School, or How to Become an Expert in Just About Anything. Boser is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, and his research explores the theory that how we learn often matters as much as what we learn. In Learn Better, Boser breaks down a systemic approach to learning so people can fully realize their brain's potential. We discussed his six-step process of learning. I'm Beth Golay, this is Marginalia, and here's our conversation. I just want to talk about your book, Learn Better. The subtitle is Mastering the Skills for Success in Life, Business, and School, or How to Become an Expert in Just About Anything. Now, if I understand this correctly, your interest in the learning process was renewed at a time when you were working on a research project to determine the relationship between school spending and test outcomes. You mentioned this at the beginning of the book, and I found it quite interesting because our state, in Kansas, the Kansas Supreme Court ruled unanimously recently that state funding to schools was inadequate, and they gave the legislature a June deadline to enact changes. So you did research, though, as far as school funding and test outcomes, but what did your research show? I mean, it might surprise a few of us in Kansas.
Yeah, I have long followed the school finance debate in Kansas and elsewhere, and it is fascinating. This has been a longstanding issue for the state. What we know about school spending is a couple of things. One, money doesn't always equal outcomes, and to a degree, this is common sense, right? If a school spends money on a large football stadium, for instance, I think we're all going to be surprised when reading scores go up. That's not to say, of course, that football doesn't play, or sports or music or art doesn't play a role in schools, but when we're thinking about the relationship between spending and outcomes, as we often want to do in education, it's clear that schools spend a lot of money on things that really don't have a huge impact on student achievement, like master's degrees are a classic example. Research is very clear that master's degrees don't increase student achievement, and yet many schools pay extra for them. What we also know historically about school spending is that poor schools don't get as much money as wealthier schools, and states and districts that have really concentrated to make sure that low-income students get their fair share have seen large increases in student achievement as well. And Kansas, like states like California and others, have struggled over the years to try and figure out, okay, how do we make this really work? How do we make sure that we target enough funds to poor kids? How do we also make sure that money is spent well and spent on the things that matter? And there's clearly been a longstanding debate in Kansas about how best to do this.
So talk to me, though, about what prompted your thinking from that email about the learning process. What made you delve deeper into the learning process as it relates to schools, but also just as it relates to us as humans?
I think in education, we often get into these debates. Should we have charter schools or not have charter schools? Should we have MOOCs in higher ed or should we not have MOOCs? Should local school boards control schools, or does the federal government play a key role? I think these debates are important, but I think it really neglects how important the interaction is between a student and the material. And we really need to think a lot more about how we can do that better. For me, what was really surprising was just the number of myths that we have about learning. So a lot of people, including our current Secretary of Education, has mentioned learning styles, that some people will learn better visually, some people learn better auditorily. Turns out there's no evidence for that. If you walk into your local law school or your local high school, you see a lot of students using highlighters. I see this a lot in my office as well. Turns out there's very little evidence for highlighters. But then some other approaches that often have a bad name, like quizzing yourself, asking yourself lots of questions, actually show tremendous effects. And that's why one of the reasons that I wanted to write this book was to share, I think, a lot of what has been in the research in sleepy academic tombs for years and hasn't really been shared with learners. And, you know, I think it also gets to a second point here, which is for a long time we assumed that learning to learn was smarts, right? This is what IQ tests were supposed to measure. They were supposed to measure your problem-solving ability. But it turns out that we can get better at learning, that there are certain tools, certain processes that allow us to gain skills and knowledge in a much better way.
So you've broken down steps to better learning into a systemic approach to developing expertise. And there are six of them, and you dedicate a chapter in your book to each of them. The six approaches are value, target, develop, extend, relate, and rethink. So let's talk about each of them just a little bit. So value.
Well, there's two things really at the value. You know, one is that with them, you know, what's in it for me? How do I find this material valuable? And we can debate about motivation. Is it intrinsic? Is it extrinsic? How do you get students, you know, more excited? And, you know, these debates are important. But when you speak to researchers, ultimately they say, you know, it's really about value, these issues of motivation. And if we don't have them, people simply don't pay attention. You know, the other thing that's important when we think about value and meaning is that people often think of themselves as like computer, right? There's data out there, there's knowledge out there, and their job is to sort of like collect that data. But our brain isn't really like a computer. We have to make the material itself valuable to ourselves to really learn. And so when you accept this as true, right, I mean, all sorts of things become more clear, right? Errors are, you know, necessary for learning. Simply reading something doesn't mean you're going to understand it. And there are ways then also to engage with material in richer ways that allow you to gain those skills rather than that feeling that I think we've all had, certainly listeners of your podcast who love to read books will have, right? We read a whole page of text and then you're like, wait, what? What did I just read? You know, so what can we do to engage a little bit richer so we really gain something from the material that we read?
You know, you also mentioned in that chapter public commitment. I found that part fascinating. Whereas if you say on Facebook, I'm going to run a marathon, you are more inclined to actually do it because you don't want to fail in front of others now that you've made that public commitment.
Yes, certainly we're all aware of the New Year's Eve promises that we have not completed. And so what are the ways that we can increase our promises to ourselves? One of them is making a public commitment, right? Posting on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram, telling everyone that we know that we're going to do something because it raises the stakes, right? I mean, it's not necessarily money, but, you know, it's our good name, our desire never to be embarrassed. And there are other ways, of course, to do it as well. There's evidence around visualizing. So the more that you might visualize a commitment, it can be a robust way to achieve that commitment, right? Because you're getting a sense of like, okay, what is it that I really want? You know, how am I going to get there? What is my plan to get there? All ways to make sure that we're going to do more to practice for that marathon and to do more to make sure that we, you know, learn how to knit or get better at dance if that's what we want to do.
You know, there's a reporter who works for our local newspaper here, and at the beginning of the year, she wrote a column on she was challenging people to read more throughout the year, and she put a list of categories of different types of books that you could read. Like, it was just 12 books, 12, you know, you have 12 months to get this done, and it might be a book by a celebrity or a book where the cover is blue or something like that. But she had them all categorized, and when she shared that column through social media, she tagged three people. One was our local independent bookstore owner. One was a friend of hers who was just a prolific reader. And I was the third. And, uh-huh. You know, it got me to stand up straighter. And, you know, I'm now accountable for, you know, trying to read all of these books and keeping track and reporting back to this Facebook group that she created. And I've been keeping track of my reading list since, oh gosh, 2001, when I started working at the independent bookstore here in town. And so I've just been looking, just the last 3 months, I'm reading a lot more books than I even have been, you know, throughout the years just working on books and whatnot or the podcast. And I think it's because I now have that accountability where I have to report back, you know, to this challenge group what I've read. And so there is something to that whole I've said this out loud and I'm going to do it. Whereas if I would have just said at the beginning of the year to myself, I think I'm going to read 12 books, I don't think I would have, you know, kept myself accountable. Anyway.
No, I think that's a great point. And I think it's really important to the idea of learning. I think it gets at to something bigger, that we do a lot of things rote, that we are simply robots in many ways, right? So driving is an example, at least for me. I drive about the same as I did when I'm 18. And, you know, and it's not a matter of sort of practice in a way, or at least not a matter of usage, right? I'm driving every day, but I don't really think about it. I'm not really planning to get better at it. I'm certainly not making commitments, as you did to my friends, right? Like, I'm going to get better at driving. There are all sorts of things that we do in life that we're like, oh, well, we do it all the time, so we're pretty good at it. You know, you think about books all the time, and yet, you know, you weren't reading as much as you wanted to, or at least as much as you could with the commitment to a friend. And, you know, when we look at something like handwriting, right, my handwriting remains awful, largely because I don't make any efforts to make it any better.
Okay, so let's talk about the next step, which is targeting.
Great. So, you know, the next step is target. What I really wanted to get across with that chapter, with that approach to learning, and this is a key step, is that when we want to learn, we have to be really focused and precise on what we want to learn. And this is so important when it's at the beginning of the learning process, right? So take riding a bike, for example. You know, the first time that you ride a bike, it is really important that you know where those brakes are. Someone has to give you that tip very specifically. And we often talk, I think, in schools and colleges about the value of hands-on learning. And later in the learning process, that's really important. But at the beginning, it's so important to target what you want to learn. Another example of this that made me feel a lot better, Beth, was that I learned about, you know, how short-term memory is. And experts increasingly believe that short-term memory is really where learning happens. And yet it's only, you know, three or five things that sit in short-term memory. And it's funny, I looked at the history of telephone numbers, and you can see over time the telephone companies are always struggling to, like, make telephone numbers shorter and shorter because it's so difficult for us to remember them. And that helps us understand why important numbers like 911 are just three digits long. That's all we can remember. And this is important for learning because it explains why we, you know, need to focus, why so many studies show that, you know, having the internet on and checking Twitter erodes our ability to learn, why it's not generally good practice unless you're doing something really rote to have music on. And so anything that we can do, you know, whether it's making a plan or making sure we have some space for quiet, really can improve our learning. And we see this in school programs like Success for All. We see this in colleges, and we're increasingly seeing this in businesses, which are offering, you know, quiet spaces for their employees. Even businesses like Google, which, you know, have long been praised for the kind of open office environment, are making these rooms where people, if they need an hour or two to write a memo, to pull together some code, have the time and place and concentration to do that.
You know, speaking of the phone numbers, do we ever reach an age where we just stop learning numbers? I came from a town where, you know, right now in Wichita, you don't need to dial the area code. You just dial the seven numbers. Uh-huh. My small town, 20 minutes west of here, you know, at the time I was growing up, we only had to dial the last four numbers. I mean, I still know all of my friends' phone numbers.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, you know, mine was 2293. My mom will say her number was two longs and a short. But, you know, I used to be able to learn birthdays or remember just dates and numbers. But, you know, I will turn 50 in October, and I can't do that anymore. I do not know my daughter's phone numbers. They are in my cell phone, and I push a button, but I've never had to learn them. Is it an age thing, or is it just my phone has taken over the convenience for me?
You know, it's fascinating. I looked into this quite a bit, and I find it fascinating because I struggled just like you did, wondering, you know, is it something with me, or is it something about, you know, who we are? And it turns out the answer is a lot about who we are. Our brain is this incredibly powerful tool, and what it knows is that it can offload things to other people. So we've done this often with friends or with partners. You know, we know, you know, my example, I know that my wife, you know, is the official family keeper of the birthdays. And so she's the person that, you know, I remind myself to do that. And now increasingly our brains are sort of doing that with our devices. They sort of offload them. What's in some ways the broader principle here that I think is fascinating, especially if you actually do want to remember something like your daughter's telephone numbers is, you know, the brain actually never forgets, right? There's a lot of evidence in the literature that shows that people don't really forget a phone number, whether it's the phone number that you had as a kid or even your friend's phone number. What really makes a difference is the degree to which you retrieve that information from your memory. And to a degree, this serves as well, right? If you're just remembering everyone's names, you're going to get sort of confused, right? If you recall the name of your daughter's boss and it was your first boss, you're going to get confused with your current boss. And so really memory runs on retrieval. And since you don't actually retrieve your daughter's numbers from your long-term memory, you're not able to then, you know, recall it when you need it. You've basically offloaded it to your phone. Generally, this works pretty well for us, but just sometimes in those times where you don't have the phone in front of you and you're just terribly embarrassed that you don't remember telephone numbers, is when it seems a little off base.
So the next chapter, develop. I mean, I'm fascinated with the basketball story. I don't know if you want to talk about that or if you want to talk about something else.
No, I'm happy to embarrass myself over the basketball story.
Okay. So for the chapter develop, you took lessons to play basketball. Tell me about that.
Yeah, it's funny. You know, I've been writing about learning in one fashion or another since I was in my 20s, and my wife was away. I recently sort of joined an informal basketball league and with some older sort of middle-aged guys, and I was particularly middle-aged. In other words, you know, I was one of the slowest, weakest players out there. My wife and kids went away for the weekend, so I thought, oh, you know, I should, you know, just try and get a tutor in this. And what was remarkable to me was what, within a few lessons, what a tremendous difference it made. You know, his feedback, his observations, it really improved my game, and it was surprising to me because I'd, you know, covered education for so long and yet hadn't sort of internalized, you know, this very key aspect that, you know, in order to get better, you need feedback. You need people to push you a little bit. And, you know, sometimes a 40-something needs a basketball coach, it turns out.
So the next step is extend.
Yeah, I mean, the extend is really this idea and goes back to this idea of we really learn because we want to make meaning out of something. And we want to be able to, you know, really understand something. And that means making connections between what you already know and what you're about to learn. And so, you know, Miles Davis, his famous album is Kind of Blue. If you've, you know, ever stepped into a coffee shop, whether it's in, you know, Wichita or Manhattan, you know, you have heard this album. It's sort of the quintessential jazz album. And really, he just taught them this new way to play through riffing. And, you know, we see a lot of evidence for this in the learning research that people who read things to themselves and talk to themselves about what they're, you know, reading, go on riffs, draw parallels, make their own connections. You know, it's really a powerful way to learn and a powerful way to engage. What this approach really requires, though, is just a lot of errors. So, Beth, I'm going to put you on the spot and say, you know, do you know what the capital of Australia is?
I'm going to guess Perth.
Ooh, that's a good guess. But
Melbourne?
I'm going to give you a third guess just to, you know, make you feel a little more uncomfortable.
Well, it's not going to be Sydney. I don't know.
It's Canberra.
Okay. Ask me one about the states. I'm good with states.
The key thing is that it's something that you feel like you should know. So another example, it's called this hypercorrection effect, right? And the point really is that what happened to me when someone asked me this question, you kind of think that you know it, and that sense of surprise when you're like, wait, what? The capital of Australia is Canberra, right? You're much more likely to know that because of that, you know, moment where you're like simply embarrassed. And then two, you know, that kind of zap of like, oh, wait, that's surprising, is a way that we're connecting that information to our, you know, information that we know previously. We're making that information more meaningful and thus more likely to know it in the future.
I notice that whenever I go to like a trivia night and there's an answer I think I know and I don't know it, well, I know them now because you want to you want to own the information. You didn't know it, so there's a reason you should have known it.
No, I mean, that's the exact same thing, right? And when we sort of riff on knowledge, when we really explore, we're much more likely to make mistakes. But, you know, that bit of trivia, whether it was a state capital that you thought you had known or, you know, the author of The Bridge on the River Kwai, where you're like, oh, I should have known that. You know, you've made that information a little bit more meaningful to yourself, and thus you're more likely to know it. Even though, you know, people often think that, you know, learning should happen without errors. That's real expertise, when making these types of mistakes actually helps you learn more effectively.
And you mentioned the need to look things up and ask why a lot. It reminded me of an amazingly intelligent friend of mine who was talking about this recipe he had made, and it had called for mission figs, and that made him ask, well, what makes a fig a mission fig? And are there different kinds of figs? And then he discovered that there were California figs. And I mean, but it just took looking at like one ingredient in a recipe to pique his curiosity and think, well, why is this the fig I should buy? So people who are lifelong learners or who are curious, I think, just really are good at that extending part.
They're really good at that extending part. They're also people who can, you know, spend a lot of time on Wikipedia, or at least that's often what happens to me. The bigger thing that is important when you think about learning from this is that we're often overconfident. We think that we know more than we actually know. And so, you know, if you ask me if I, you know, generally believe that I knew what a fig is, I'd say yes. But then, you know, tell me to explain the difference between a mission fig and a California fig. One, this is the first time I've heard that there's a different fig, and I wouldn't be able to explain. And this happens to a lot of us when we're learning something, especially at the beginning part of the process. We think we kind of know it well, but then we have to do these things like explain it to someone else or, you know, take a quiz. And that, you know, shows us that we're probably a little bit overconfident. We have to go back and revisit and gain a little bit more.
And so the next chapter is relate. You gave an example of a wine class and how tasting certain wines with certain foods made people understand, like, the fatty content of a lamb would cut down the tannins or things like that. Talk to me a little bit about relating this information in the journey of learning.
Yeah, what I found interesting here was, you know, what does it really mean to know something? What does it really mean to be an expert? And people who study this increasingly believe that expertise is knowing about relationships, knowing about systems, understanding analogies. And I, you know, thought that this was fascinating, and they were able to document it in math. People who have more than a rote knowledge, right, they're able to make new connections. They're able to document this in science. And so I guess I was a little bit goofy and was like, oh, well, let me see if this holds up in wine. And so I took a wine pairing class. I'm not a wine expert, but it was amazing to me, you know, once you start thinking about how wine pairs with food, you know, why does sweet wines go well with spicy things? You know, how do tannins interact with cheeses? It made me think a lot more deeply about wine. I still can't, you know, tell, you know, Plonk from a $500 bottle, but learning it in this way of compare and contrast clearly had a really big impact on me. And I think it gives us a sense of, you know, how we can really learn something deeply, how we can do that more quickly, is to think about analogies, try and make connections, think about systems. When this happens, what happens then? It's just a richer way to understand something and get us out of that rote form of learning that I think we can all agree isn't all that effective.
And then the last step is rethink. I'm just going to say,
yeah,
go.
Right. Rethink is, you know, to me really interesting, because one, you know, as we've been talking about, you know, being overconfident is really dangerous to our learning. But there's something more going on here, and that is that we simply need time to dwell on a piece of information to really understand that. We often think about this idea in terms of creativity, right? That experience, maybe you've had it, I certainly have it, you know, where you take a shower and that's when you figure out a new way to solve a problem at work. But it turns out really important for learning too, that we increasingly realize that, you know, people need pauses to allow information to sink in. There's some evidence where teachers should, you know, when they're delivering it, and this would go for managers or anyone who's just, you know, trying to deliver information, to give longer pauses in between comments, there's research to show that, you know, 3 to 5 seconds is really what's preferable to allow people the time to have that information, you know, really, you know, sink in. And the more that we can kind of allow for that type of deliberation, that reflection, sometimes people do it in terms of writing, kind of writing about what they've learned. Sometimes people, you know, just need those moments of quiet to try and let that information sink in. But it's a key part of the learning process. And, you know, we're a society that's really primed for action, to do, to get things done. And yet we need these quiet moments to get better at learning.
What kinds of goals can people achieve by using this practice? I mean, I have a 50 before 50 list, and on that list is, you know, I want to learn French. I don't think that is ever going to happen because I don't think I'm capable of learning another language. So are there better goals than others for this approach, or can you use it for any goal?
I mean, you can use it for any goal. Let's be clear that, you know, the nature of some topics like learning French are just a little bit different. You know, it's really important when you learn French to get your basic language vocabulary down, and you know, that being is really important, and so you want to space out your learning, a lot of evidence behind that. And when you're learning something like a skill, right, like, you know, diving, you know, your prior knowledge is going to be less important. But, you know, what we know from the research, and the book talks a lot about this, is, you know, certain practices like making sure you're active, asking yourself questions, as we've often talked about, making sure you interleave or mix up your learning. So if you want to get better at playing the piano, you're much better off. Some people, when they're playing the piano, might do all Mozart on one day and all Bach on the next day and then all Haydn on the next day. And they're really better in each practice. Mixing it up makes learning a little bit more difficult, but it makes it a little bit more conscious, a little bit more meaningful. And then also just spacing out your learning, you know, just doing it in smaller chunks over time. Basically, anything you can do to avoid cramming shows tremendous effects, and it doesn't make a difference of whether you're getting better at diving or learning knitting or improving your French.
So anything to avoid cramming, like I just did for this interview.
You know, it's funny because I was, you know, like, well, I'm writing a book on learning. I should really, you know, apply this myself. So really tried to, you know, there's a lot of evidence around, you know, not to cram, as I mentioned. So I really tried to spread out the writing to be more effective. I'll let you be the judge of whether or not it produced a better book, but it's certainly, you know, one way to make it a little bit more achievable.
That was Ulrich Boser, author of the book Learn Better, which was published by Rodale. Thanks for joining us for Marginalia. Discover new episodes at kmuw.org or through iTunes. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita. Our editor is Luann Stevens. Our engineer is John Cyphers, and I am the producer. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.